So good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the first of hopefully many question and answer sessions by the family team at Sintons. My name's Louise Masters and I'm the partner in the team, and this is my colleague Sophie Dodds and she's a solicitor.
Yes, thank you, Louise. So today we are hosting this Q&A session as part of Good Divorce Week. So Good Divorce Week has been running the whole of this week from Monday to Friday, and it is to raise awareness about family law professionals in general. And this particular one for Good Divorce Week 2021, the focus is on how parents can embrace a child-focused approach to separation. So Resolution is a community of family law professionals who look to resolve disputes in a constructive way. Members take a non-confrontational approach when resolving disputes, and the aim is to deal with matters as amicably as possible.
Thank you. So when we had this idea a few weeks ago, we thought we would offer the opportunity for people to ask burning questions about family law. And honestly, we were astounded at how many questions came in such a short space of time. Because, you know, if you have a family issue, there's a lot online, but you might just need the answer to a certain question. All of them were anonymous, and we've picked out some of the best ones, but also some of the common themes, because a lot of people were asking a lot of the same questions. So what we're going to do is just go through the questions which have been asked and answer them one by one. And as I said, hopefully this is one of a series. We're going to do a next question and answer on the 17th of December. And again, we would welcome further questions. So, Sophie, one of the main questions we got was, how do I start my divorce?
So the majority of divorce applications are made online now, so professionals do have to submit their applications online. And if you came to us and you were looking to make your divorce, we would need the contact details of yourself and your partner, your marriage certificate, which can either be the original marriage certificate or a certified copy. And we would also need some documentation of if you have changed your name since the marriage. So the court fee at the moment to make a divorce application is £593. And depending on your income, you may be eligible for an exemption from that. So the divorce application includes, like I said, general contact details, and you also have to give the reasons for the divorce, which we'll touch upon shortly. So to get divorced, you have to have been married for over 1 year. The relationship must have permanently broken down, and the marriage must also be recognised in the UK. So, Louise, the next question is, do I need a specific reason to divorce my partner?
Thank you. So at the moment, yes, you do. And you have to prove to the court that the marriage is broken down beyond repair. And Sophie touched upon that there. So if you are unsure about whether your relationship is broken down completely, we would always encourage you to go to, for example, counselling sessions with your spouse, just to explore things further. Because as I say, the court needs to be sure that your marriage is broken down beyond repair. And they do actually ask a question whether you've been referred to any of these agencies to help with the relationship. So if it's broken down beyond repair, to prove that, you have to currently rely on one of five facts. Three of those facts are based on you and your spouse being separated for 2 years or more. So a lot of them don't apply, you know, so most people separate and then want to take steps to divorce. So the only remaining two reasons are adultery and unreasonable behaviour. Now that's really sad, because if you separate and want to divorce, you have to blame the other person at this stage. But you may have heard in the press, and we've done some articles on it and podcasts, that coming shortly, hopefully spring of 2022, is what's called no-fault divorce. So the current law that we operate within is 40 odd years old, but the law is changing in April of next year. And what will happen is that you don't need to blame the other person. You just need to say to the court, we've grown apart or whatever, and we'd like to get a divorce. So that's brilliant. That really sits well with the Good Divorce Week that we're promoting, because the point about no-fault divorce is that you are taking out anything inflammatory. So you're not having to say these awful things about your spouse when you might not want to, but in the current remit, you have to. So that's a great step forward. As I say, we're not really sure how it's going to look in practice because that hasn't been released yet. And we're not absolutely sure when it will come in, but we're hoping it will be April 2022. And I should say there, whilst it will be no-fault divorce, which is great, we think that the law will say you're not allowed to blame the other person past April. And that's just something to bear in mind. We would always encourage people to keep the reasons mellow in any event. But past April, you won't be able to blame the other person. Which leads us nicely on to the next question. Does it matter who starts the divorce first?
So Louise has just touched upon the reasons for the divorce, and it doesn't matter who starts the divorce in practice. However, if you are to use one of those blame factors, either adultery or unreasonable behaviour, and you haven't been separated for over 2 years, then you would have to use one of those two facts. You can't rely on your own adultery or unreasonable behaviour. So if that is applicable in your circumstance, then that may give you the answer as to who needs to make the application. Overall, though, the reason for the divorce, which a lot of people do worry about, is the impact of the reason for the divorce on the financial settlement. And what we can say to hopefully put some of your minds at ease is that the reason for the divorce should have no bearing on the financial settlement reached. So in practice, they are kept as two separate entities, the divorce and the financial remedy. So next we have a couple of questions, so moving away from divorce, and these are focused more so on the children and the arrangements for the children on separation. So firstly, Louise, how does the court decide on child custody during divorce? You may want to touch on the word custody.
And I will, because it really frustrates me. So a lot of people still use the word custody, and actually that was taken out of law years and years and years ago. And when it was taken out, it moved to residence and contact, and that was used for a number of years. So generally, in those eras, the mother would get residence, i.e. the children would live with her and they would have contact with the dad. But that also provided for an unequal playing field between parents who really should be equal. And because what would happen, the person who had residence, who would usually be the mother, would say, well, they live with me, so I'm making this decision and you're not. And actually, most parents have parental responsibility for those children. And if you have parental responsibility, it means that any important decisions should be made jointly. And it doesn't matter where the children live, it's the parental responsibility that should be used equally. So what happened a couple of years ago, the terminology in the law changed again, and the court much prefer now the child arrangements. So the children will live with this parent on these days and this parent on these days, and it doesn't matter whether one parent has a lot more of the days, you are on an equal playing field, so the children live with both parents at different times of the week. How does the court decide on the arrangements for the children? Well, and actually it says during a divorce, so the court wouldn't usually get involved from the outset with regard to the children. The best thing to do is try to talk to your other half to see what is best for the children. It's not about what you want and it's not about what your other half wants. It's about what is best for these children and what will work the best in their lives. If you aren't able to discuss matters, we would always recommend that you consider things like mediation. We're going to come on to that later, but in a nutshell, mediation is a facility where you can both go along without the children, and a mediator will facilitate your discussions. So if, for example, it's getting a bit heated or you've reached an impasse, the mediator will help you work through those things to figure out what's best for your family. And if you can't agree things together, if mediation doesn't work, if solicitor involvement isn't moving things forward, then you may need to apply to the court to have some court input. Now, the premise is that both parents should have a really good say in the children's lives and share the time with them, unless it's not safe to do so. And various risk factors would be things like domestic abuse, which now includes coercive control, psychological abuse, financial abuse. Other risk factors could be, for example, drinking to excess. But if none of those are apparent, then really the court would decide that the children should live with both parents, and each case is dealt with on its specific facts, because we all have different lives, and the judge would just need to think what is best for these children and make that decision. But the court also have a principle of no order, which means that they're not just going to make a court order about children if it's not necessary. And that brings me back to what I was saying initially. You should try and figure out things yourself. There's loads of resources out there, such as CAFCATS or Resolution, as Sophie's mentioned, who have tools which can help you work through these issues. We've got links to them on our family website at Sintons, so you might want to go on there to click through to see what resources are out there to help you. And kind of on the same vein, the next question we've been asked quite a lot is, do judges prefer mothers?
So the simple answer is no. So we will assume this question relates to child arrangement proceedings. So just following on from what Louise said. So these proceedings occur when you have not been able to reach an agreement outside of court. So we would never be advising you to just run off and make that application because of the principle that Louise has just mentioned, the no order principle. So it only comes around child arrangement proceedings when you really are at loggerheads and you cannot reach an agreement between yourselves and you've explored all those other options. The court will also want evidence that you have explored those options. So when you make your application to court, they would be asking for a mediation certificate to say that, you know, you've tried to resolve the issue outside of court and you haven't been able to. So when the court decides child arrangements, the main focus and the primary concern is on the best interests of the child. So not on either parent, it is in what is in the best interests of the child. So they look at the welfare checklist as well. So as much as the best interest is the primary concern, there are certain factors that the court do consider when they are making a child arrangements order. And they include the ascertainable wishes and feelings of the child's physical, emotional, and psychological needs, the likely effect on the child of a change of circumstances, the child's age, sex, and background, any harm which the child has suffered or is at risk of suffering, how capable the parents are in meeting that child's needs, and the range of powers that the court has. So, as Louise mentioned, the view of the court is that unless there is a good reason why not, it is said that a child should have a positive and meaning relationship with both parents, and this is said to be what is in the best interests of the child unless there is a good reason why not. So overall, judges do not favour either party, and it is completely child focused. So to clarify, judges do not prefer mothers.
And I was just going to say as well, in this day and age, when both parties tend to forge careers, both of them take an active childcare role, and in some cases, which is becoming more and more increasing, fathers do. So, you know, it is case specific. So if you had a case where the dad was the primary carer, it may be that in court, the children spend more time with the dad just because of the way that family's set up. So for any dads out there, you do need to be reassured it's about what's best for the child and they don't necessarily favour mothers.
Right, so now we're going to move on to the finances. So as we mentioned earlier, the divorce and the finances are usually two separate entities, although they are linked in some way, we do treat them as separate things. So the first question we've got in relation to finances, Louise, is will I lose 50% of everything if I divorce my partner?
There is no easy answer to this because when the court are looking at the finances upon divorce, they take into account a range of factors. The first consideration is the housing needs of both parties, and the next consideration is income needs. And when they're looking at those needs, they'll take into account the ages of the parties, what they both work as, and their earning capacity. Whether there are any children, any disabilities, conduct issues, and any other factors. And the any other factors would include things like prenuptial agreements. So there is no hard and fast rule that you would lose 50%. But what you need to think about is what the court will look at is marital acquests. This is the money that has been built up over the marriage. And you're not losing it because it is family money. So basically, it's being shared out to meet both of your needs. And just to give an example, there may be a case where one party comes out with more than 50%. And that's on the basis, for example, one of the parties is the primary carer, has a little part-time job, and the other party has quite a successful career. So it may be in that case that the primary carer of the children needs a little bit more than 50%, or in some cases a lot more than 50%, so that they can set up home elsewhere with the children. And the premise is they would not be able to get as big mortgage as the other person. So it is case by case basis, and the tricky thing about sorting out the finances on divorce is judges have the criteria I've already mentioned, but they also have discretion, and I genuinely think that their personal circumstances and background comes into it as well. So if you give one set of facts about a marriage and finances to five different judges, it is probable that you will come out with five different decisions. So it's always tricky for solicitors to advise exactly to the pound what you'll come out with. But we do know from experience and the cases we deal with in case law, within a ballpark, what is likely to happen. So there is no hard and fast answer to that. It is case specific. It may be 50%. It may be more than 50%. So you would just really be encouraged to take some legal advice before you begin trying to separate it out, because we have clients come in who they've tentatively reached an agreement with their spouse about who takes what, and actually it is really unfair because of the circumstances of that case. So I think all I would say about that is you really need to take some legal advice before you reach any final decisions about the money. And the next question kind of links in with the divorce that we were talking about earlier. And we have had this question a lot. So does the fact that I have had an extramarital affair affect my financial standing in divorce?
Yes, so I did touch upon this earlier. So the fact in the divorce application does not automatically impact on the financial settlement reached. So as Louise mentioned, in April 2022, no-fault divorce is going to come in. So there will be no blame factor whatsoever. So like I've said throughout this Q&A, the general rule is that the divorces and the finances should be kept separate. However, conduct is a factor that the courts do take into account when they are deciding what the financial settlement would be, but it is very rarely used in practice as an argument, and this is because the conduct needs to be extremely severe for it to be taken into account and basically mean that one party gets a larger share than the other. So by severe conduct, we are talking about potentially grievous bodily harm, attempted murder of the other partner, and also some severe misconduct in relation to a family business or something like that. So in a nutshell, an extramarital affair does not come anywhere close to that level of bad conduct. So it would be our position that we'd say that should not be a factor that should be taken into account when it comes to the finances.
If, however, you have withdrawn, and we were just talking about this, withdrawn a lot, say for example, £100,000 out of the joint family account and given it to your new partner, that would be taken into account and that money would be added back in. So the fact that you've had a relationship with somebody else, if it's just a relationship, that wouldn't have an impact on the finances. But if you've done something silly, like we've just talked about there, or dangerous, it's likely to be taken into account.
So financial misconduct.
Exactly. Thank you. So the next couple of questions are different to what we've already talked about, but they came through anonymously, a common theme. So the first one.
What is the difference between divorce mediation and divorce collaboration?
Okay, so there's various ways to sort out the children, the finances, and all of the other finite details when you're separating. You can do it between yourselves if you're able to have that communication. You can have lawyers involved who will write letters and advise you along the way. I've touched upon mediation, so just to reiterate, mediation can be used for children issues or financial issues, and you would both go along to a mediator who is professionally trained to facilitate your discussions. Now, the mediator can bring other people into the mediation, such as a family consultant, who will help with the emotional side of things. They could bring an accountant in, a tax planner. They could have other professionals in to support the discussions in the hope of trying to reach an agreement about whatever you've got an issue. Mediation is off the record, so whatever you discuss there couldn't then be taken to court. And the aim of mediation is to get a mediated settlement, which would be written up, but then you should always have that settlement checked out by a lawyer before you approve it and sign it off. Because again, we've had mediated agreements come in which actually on the face of it aren't fair. So always have it checked out by a lawyer. Collaborative practice is where we would bring everybody together with lawyers to try and come up with the best outcome for the family overall. And we can do collaborative practice about finances and the children. And again, you can bring other people into the meeting to support the process. And we would really encourage that because there's so much going on when you go through a separation. You need as much support to get through it and to get the right outcome for your family. So it's a bit of an odd setup because there may be sometimes in a collaborative meeting where I favour the other side, what they're saying, and the other lawyer might favour my client. But the point of it is we're working together to achieve what's best for the family. So there's loads of different ways to resolve disputes. And again, there's loads of information on our website about the different options. So it's worth just having a look and seeing what might fit for your family best. Now, next one, we're moving on to a completely different theme. My partner is abusive. Can I attempt to obtain a restraining order as part of the divorce proceedings?
Okay, so a restraining order is a criminal matter and this would be obtained by the police. But in civil and family law, we can obtain what's known as a non-molestation order, which is very similar to a restraining order. So a non-molestation order is used to prevent someone using or threatening violence against another person or a child. And this can include threats, writing on social media, pestering, harassment, and also persistent text messages and telephone calls, which unfortunately in our job, we do come across these issues quite a lot. And non-molestation orders can also exclude someone from a particular place. So it could be that they can't come, for example, within 100 metres of a property or within that street, or even 100 metres from a school or something like this. And the order can be made for between 6 and 12 months. And if it is breached, it carries a sentence which is punishable of up to 5 years imprisonment. So they are extremely serious, but they can be a great tool to stop that harassment that you are facing.
And I was going to say, it doesn't just have to be on divorce. You can have a non-molestation order against an associated person. So that could be someone who you lived with or you were engaged to or have a child with. So it's across the spectrum of family law, really. And remember what I said earlier about domestic abuse. It's not just the physical violence, which a lot of people associate with domestic abuse. It's emotional violence, psychological, coercive control, financial abuse. So bear all of those things in mind as well. In terms of safety, if you do feel that you are at risk of harm, you just need to dial 999 and then you would come and see us straight away. So protect yourself in that way, but then back it up with coming to see us and then we can pursue a non-molestation order if the circumstances provide for that.
Yes, so this question did say as part of the divorce proceedings. So as Louisa said, it wouldn't be something that is part of the divorce proceedings, but if a non-molestation order was necessary, then your family law solicitor, for example ourselves, could make that application alongside your divorce application and the two can run alongside one another. Okay, so we've reached our final question of today, again on a completely separate issue. So this question relates to, so it says, my son has split from his wife and she isn't allowing us to see the children. What rights do I have? So this particularly relates to grandparents.
Okay, so yeah, we get this query quite a lot because sadly when relationships break down, it is a common theme that one party will not allow the other set of grandparents to see the children. So what rights do grandparents have? Unfortunately, none. What you need to do is start a dialogue with the mother or father who isn't allowing the contact. And again, that could be through solicitors, mediation. A family consultant could help to deal with the emotional side of things. And you would try and agree the contact arrangements between or through those methods. The tricky thing is, you know, if the children are school age, there is only so much time in a week that can be carved up for parents, grandparents. So it is really tricky to get that balance. And it may be that if the parent can organise contact, then the grandparents would tag on to that. But if you can't reach an agreement, grandparents can apply to the court, but unfortunately they don't have an automatic right to apply to the court. First of all, need to apply for permission to make the application to court. Now, permission is likely to be granted if you have had a relationship with the grandchildren pre the breakdown of the relationship. So I think you need to act while the iron is still hot. And if there's been a separation and the contact has broken down, come and see your solicitor, get your application in the court if that's what's required, because you're going to have to prove to the court I've got this relationship with the children, we've been fully involved with their life, and that's why I should be given permission to take this forward. Don't be disheartened though if there is no relationship there at all. There are still other factors why you could be given permission, and we can explore those if you get in touch. So there are ways and means, but it's not an automatic right.
Great. Well, that is the end of our Q&A session today. So as Louise mentioned at the start, we have been inundated with the amount of questions, and we can't thank you enough for submitting your questions. So please keep them coming, as we are going to do this now on a monthly basis. And our next Q&A session will be on Friday, the 17th of December. And we would love to see you there.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.